This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And the same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the show, you can find it online at that same address, prairiepublic.org. And this is our second COVID-19 interactive town hall today. We're going to focus on public schools and higher education. We've got a couple of experts with us today. That's Kirsten Baszler. She's North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction, a very busy state leader right now. Kirsten, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
And from Grand Forks, Jeff Holm. He's the Vice Provost for Online Education and Strategic Planning at the University of North Dakota. Thank you for being with us, Jeffrey.
Glad to be here, too.
We have numbers that people can call, and of course you can Main Street email us as well. The number toll-free is 888-755-6377. Or you can go online and email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Just for the 3 o'clock show, the 7 o'clock show is a rebroadcast, so we'll be at home listening along with you, I hope. Let's start, first of all, with you, Kirsten. Let's get a snapshot update on circumstances and instruction for K-12 in North Dakota.
Certainly. It's been a whirlwind few weeks, I will tell you. Beginning in March 13th, when the governor and I had a press conference and announced that we gave the schools certain guidelines to use based on confirmed cases of COVID in our schools or their communities, and asked them to make that determination locally. By the time Sunday rolled around, things had accelerated so quickly, and the information that we were receiving indicated that we probably didn't have enough tests being conducted or administered in the state in order to make a decision about to keep our schools open or not. And so the governor did an executive order to close our schools the week of the 16th through the 20th to provide our school district leaders and their teachers to develop a distance learning plan if that would be necessary, if we would extend our closings. And by Thursday of that week, we had another press conference, and the governor did indicate clearly during that announcement that our school buildings in North Dakota would be closed until further notice. And I emphasized the word and underscored the word buildings very clearly, because in that same press conference and in that same order, the governor laid out his expectation that even though our buildings of learning would be closed, that that instruction, teaching, and learning would continue. He gave our school districts March 27th to submit a plan to the Department of Public Instruction for my team to review and pass on to him for approval, and that plan needed to detail how they were going to manage a full continuation of learning for age-appropriate distance learning beginning no later than April 1st until the end of the school year. So our school buildings are closed until further notice, and teaching and learning continues on in full force in North Dakota. All 173 of our school districts submitted a plan by the deadline, and all of those were approved by the governor. There was some back and forth on some of them, on the majority of them, but by that Wednesday, they had all been approved.
Well, we should mention that in Minnesota, on the other side of the Red River, Governor Tim Walz has extended the stay-at-home order through May 4th. So that has developed on that side of the boundary in Minnesota and North Dakota. Let's get an update on UND from Jeff. I know that UND summer sessions will be online. I did see that on your website, Jeff. What else has been changed as business as usual by this pandemic?
Well, as you know, we first announced that we would take 2 weeks after spring break and move our instruction to what we referred to as remote learning. And that term was chosen purposefully to distinguish between a design planned online experience versus one that was needed in a crisis situation like we were and still are in. And so shortly into that two-week period, then it was extended to finish the spring term using the remote learning that we had set up. Many of our courses are online or were originally online, but those that weren't, again, moved to this concept of a remote learning, which, I can't speak for all the MDUS institutions, but I don't want to downplay their efforts either. I'm sure their efforts have matched our own in terms of faculty have worked extraordinarily hard to ensure that students can finish this term successfully and meet their learning goals. And recently, we made a decision that we would, given the current situation, that we would move all of our summer courses to an online delivery mode as well. Typically, our summer is heavily online anyways. Probably 80% of our courses are online in the summer, so it wasn't a big change. But nonetheless, we are taking steps to ensure that in the summer, we can really refer to and will refer to those courses as online courses designed and planned rather than the emergency situation we find ourselves in right now.
Jeff Holm is Vice Provost for Online Education and Strategic Planning at UND. Again, if you want to ask a question of Jeff or Kirsten Basler, North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction, it's easy to do. Just pick up the phone, 888-755-6377, or email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We did receive a couple of email questions, and I think these are sort of aimed at Kirsten, so I'll share one of these with you. This is from a grade school teacher in the Fessenden-Bowdoin public school system. I am sharing two stories with you in this email. First will be my struggle story. I am a teacher having a tough time leaving my work at school because I'm dealing with it 24/7, being at home while taking care of two young children. I will receive messages from 8 a.m. until sometimes 10 p.m. from students and parents, so I feel overwhelmed and stressed that way. Then I do have a success story that all of my 14 students have been actively participating in the online learning opportunities and reaching out to me to share. So I know this is hard for students and families, but it is also very trying for teachers, too. In no way is this an early summer vacation. Kirsten, some reflection from you about one of your teachers out there.
Thank you so much. I want to thank that teacher for taking in and sharing both sides of the situation out there, the successes, but there certainly are tremendous, tremendous adjustments and, you know, not anything short of incredibly hard challenges out there. I want to give a shout out to our teachers and our child nutrition providers, our custodians, our bus drivers, our paraprofessionals, our families, our students, everyone involved during this time. They are doing so much for us to be grateful for, so much that we can look to that we have not had the opportunity to acknowledge in the past. I think if anything has come out of this, one of the things that has is just the understanding and the incredible work that our teachers and all of our educators that I include in all of those titles that I just mentioned. They do so much for our state every day, and much of it goes unnoticed. And now there's been a lot more spotlight, a time to really highlight and spotlight those things. This teacher, she shares a lot of the concerns that I've heard. I'm in the process of getting together a call of teachers so I can hear these things on a more regular basis. I want to have an opportunity for just teachers to call in and share their successes and their challenges and their struggles each day. One of the things that I can say is that I have a family cabinet. I have a family engagement cabinet that previously met quarterly with me face-to-face at the Capitol, and we've transitioned that to virtual calls, obviously, and we've met weekly. And that is one of the things that became the most apparent to me, was you suddenly have two parents that are now telecommuting, working from home, yet they have, so they're trying to give 100% to their employer, yet they have two, three, maybe five children at home that they are now responsible for the supervision and facilitation sometimes of these educational learning journeys that they're on through a distance education plan. We have to be patient with each other. We have to be kind. Even these distance learning plans that were put forward to me by March 27th and approved, everything looks good on paper, but the implementation is where the rubber really hits the road. And so I really want to encourage all of our teachers to be communicating with their principals, communicating with their families. And if things just simply aren't working to the best outcome for students and families at this point, and that includes families that are teachers, let's make some adjustments and readjust along the way. What we need to do is make sure that everyone comes out at the end of this healthy and whole. And that means whole academically and whole emotionally as well.
Jeff, let's talk about virtual campus visits. This is a recruitment season as well for universities across the country and in North Dakota. And orientation of new students, that kind of thing. How is that adjusting?
Actually, surprisingly good, I think. That is a challenge, of course, but, you know, the technology is there. And, you know, one of the positive side effects, I think, of all of this that's going on right now is it is making it necessary for people to look at alternative ways of achieving what they want to achieve. And I know that the group at UND has been working round the clock to create video tours, interactive virtual tours to allow students and their families to get the best sense. Obviously, you know, nothing beats, I'm vice provost for online education, but nothing beats coming to campus and immersing yourself in that experience, walking around, seeing the buildings, kind of touching the history of the place. But we can't do that right now. So what's another best option? And as you said, virtual tours are becoming very popular. You know, real estate has used them in houses for actually years, really. And so universities are moving in that direction as we are. And so far, the feedback's been quite good.
You're listening to the COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall about education in North Dakota. The number is 888-755-6377, or you can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Mark in Minot did that. He emailed us with the question. So, Kirsten, we may as well ask it. I don't know that there's an answer, but what COVID milestones do we need to hit in order for kids to return to the classroom?
That is probably one of my most frequently asked questions. So when will our kids get to go back into the school buildings? All I can say at this point are a couple indicators and a couple metrics that I have become aware of. Well, as we all know, the governor's executive order says until further notice. And so that's the most certainty that we have. So uncertainty is the most certainty that we have until further notice. But with that, Governor Burgum has been asked this question at a few different forums where I've heard the answer that he has best been able to give. First of all, he points to the president's order of social distancing to continue until at least April 30th. So that is one indicator that I know is on his mind. The other answer that he has given, and the other indicator as to be used as a potential metric, is he said he won't be considering that or reconsidering that until our confirmed cases of COVID are on the decline for a substantial number of days. So Governor Burgum and I are both very much optimists, and we would both love to see those kids back in the classrooms, maybe even for at least a week or two at the end of the year, so they can reconnect with their classmates, their teachers, finish out the year, that those seniors can have that opportunity to have their last week in the school building that they likely spent their entire K-12 career in. But it would be, as the governor says, it would be fantastic for schools to open for sometime in May, at least a few days to allow these things to happen. He did not say that it was likely. So I think the best thing that we can hope for is that we can get these confirmed cases on the decline and that we can contain the spread and make sure that we have everything in place to prevent a second surge.
Jeff, you are the Vice Provost for Online Education and Strategic Planning. So what kind of a wrench has this event thrown into the strategic planning process for the university?
Well, I think it's, and sometimes it's highlighted, you know, the old saying, the, you know, best laid plans.
Yes.
But I also, I do think that it has highlighted a very important point, and that is that all of us, and this isn't just higher education, I'd say, you know, this goes to businesses, this goes to K-12 education, government in general.
Yes.
You know, we have to be prepared for emergencies such this one. We talk about natural disasters. I live in the Red River Valley. I was here in the 1997 flood. So obviously we think of things like that, but now we have the virus, this virus situation as well. And so I think that what we've started to do is just to essentially discuss a variety of options, keeping in mind that we need to be flexible and take things in a sense day by day toward achieving our outcomes and be prepared to make a left turn and get to where we need to go a slightly different way.
Our COVID-19 Interactive Town Hall is focusing on education in North Dakota today. The toll-free number is 888-755-6377. The email address is mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Kirsten, we got an email from somebody, a high school principal in North Dakota, that says something very interesting here, and we need to remember that the United States is really reeling from the impact of the pandemic. It's the hottest place in the world right now, but there have been other countries that have really been focuses of it as well. And this one says, our foreign exchange student had to leave abruptly to return to Spain. His agency recommended he finish his year through our distance learning. So he enrolled in that distance learning classes, and he's communicating from Spain, and teachers are being flexible and making necessary accommodations for the time change. And she goes on to say, we had a supply pickup line on March 19th to get students' locker contents and instructional materials home. With one day's notice, the community responded amazingly. We had 100% of our families come through the line to claim those items. The whole process took a little over 3 hours. And this note came from a high school boy to this high school principal. He said, most people overlook how much of a learning curve it likely was for all of our teachers to switch to this new method. But we all feel that it's nice to see all the effort and learning that our teachers are doing to help us get through this process. And the principal ends by saying, we are a stronger school and community because of the way we've worked together through this crisis. So that's heartening to hear.
Isn't that? That is so. But, you know, I am so fortunate because of the work that I do. I get to see that every day in my work. I've known for a long time, I think, what North Dakota is discovering about itself. Our teachers, our building principals, our district leaders, our students and our families, they're like none other than I've ever met. And I'm so blessed and so fortunate to be the leader of North Dakota schools because of this. I share these stories with my colleagues, and we just rise up. I describe North Dakota as one community with a really long Main Street. And it's such an accurate description, but we are showing our best selves right now, and that story certainly exemplified it.
I think Lloyd Omdahl, former lieutenant governor, of course a professor at UND for many years, once said North Dakota had a couple of main streets. One was I-94, the other was I-29, and the state is very much a community because of its size. Jeff, the disruption here is going to hit the bottom line in some way. What are you hearing? What is the university hearing from the university system, and what sort of processes have been started to sort of assess the damage to the bottom line and how revenue and budgets will have to be adjusted?
Well, once again, I think that the current status is taking things one day at a time, and what are reasonable and responsible ways to address the disruption that both our students and our faculty and our staff have dealt with during this time. And, you know, so there are discussions about housing and dining refunds for students that had to leave campus. I think the bigger issue, though, in all that and the biggest unknowns are what's going to happen in the next 6 months to a year with higher education. And this isn't just in North Dakota. This is nationwide. This is worldwide, actually.
Yes.
And there are reasons to believe that there could be some increases, at least in some delivery modes, particularly in the online area. But, of course, there's also some suggestion that many universities, at least in the short term, will see some decreases in enrollments that are the result of not just the virus itself, but the economic impact of the virus. So we are, it's a day-to-day thing. We're monitoring those things daily. I think what our focus in, again, is to provide the best higher education we can to the citizens of this state. You know, I see myself and my fellow professors and instructors very similar to the farmer in our state. We deal with whatever adversity comes up. We do the best we can to serve the citizens of this state, and we work round the clock if need be. If we can take a break between those shifts, we do, but we are prepared to respond because we love our state, just like the farmers of the state.
Kirsten, we've been talking about a lot of things that have sort of fallen into place that seem to be working in terms of this adjustment to the COVID-19 pandemic and moving to online learning. What are the challenges right now? What isn't working so well?
So I think the challenge is not so much the technology. I do have to give a shout out to North Dakota right now. We've done an analysis of our students' broadband connectivity, and there are 72,000 homes in North Dakota which are served by the broadband association companies that have K through 12 students in them. And of those 72,000 homes that have K-12 students, 0.2% don't currently have access to broadband internet, 0.2%.
So how are they incredible. How are they accommodated?
So we're working on solutions for those 0.2%. We're working on the solutions to those problems as we speak. Broadband association companies are working to get them connected. We're coordinating with our telecommunications companies like AT&T, Verizon, getting them hotspots, working on solutions as we speak. But that's an incredible number. As I get on the telephone calls with my national colleagues, that's certainly not the statistics that they're having. They're having maybe 60% of their kids are connected, not 0.2% that don't have the access. So those things are working well, the connectivity, the robustness of the connectivity. The biggest challenge is something that the teacher from President Bowdoin alluded to, the scheduling, the routine. You may have two parents that are doing video conferencing, and then if you have three children, how do you all utilize that laptop or the three laptops that are there and the video streaming, video conferencing broadband?
That's a lot of bandwidth there, yeah.
Yes, it is. And so really our teachers, our school districts are working through maybe doing recordings and having students access those recordings of the lesson at a non-traditional time, like not everyone at 9 o'clock in the morning, but maybe then families can adjust with the schedule. And do that scheduling in a little bit of more of a distributed sort of way. So scheduling, getting in the routine, making sure that the rhythm and the dance of a family is still manageable, and then basic logistical things such as the Dropbox. So where's the Dropbox in this? And how there's the panic and fear of you've spent all this time on an assignment and you put it in the Dropbox and it disappears. Are you
Ouch.
Sure you're going to get an A? If you can't connect and the test is going to start at 10:15 and you're not there, so it's more about scheduling and rhythm and cadence right now.
Oh, my heart started to beat a little faster when you described those issues. That happens in our business as well. We're talking with Kirsten Baszler, North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction, and Jeff Holm, the Vice Provost for Online Education and Strategic Planning. It's our COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall. Again, you can call us at 888-755-6377 or email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And we'll be back with your calls and emails and more discussion with Kirsten and Jeff after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. With an increase in drug overdoses in Fargo in recent weeks, police are urging those who are with an overdose victim to seek help immediately. Spokeswoman Jessica Schindeldecker says there have been 6 overdoses and 1 death. Heroin is the suspected drug.
The North Dakota Immunity Overdose Protection Law covers persons involved in the incident from being charged or paraphernalia or possession of heroin in the event that they need to call for emergency medical services when there's an overdose. So that's what we're really hoping people remember, that if they're using, they know somebody or they know somebody who is overdosing, to call 911 immediately, because minutes really matter.
Fargo police carry Narcan, which can reverse the effects of an overdose. Investigators are working to determine the source of the heroin. When COVID-19 forced the shuttering of schools and food service establishments, it caused a disruption in the supply chain for dairy farmers. Farmer relations manager for Midwest Dairy, Mitch Schulte, says suddenly there was little or no demand for things like individual cartons of milk and 25-pound bags of shredded cheese. He says this oversupply has producers looking for a home for their products.
These processors and co-ops are evaluating by a case-by-case scenario. As they deal with the disruption in the supply chain, they'll make the decision on whether they may have to periodically dispose of milk to adjust that supply or not.
On the positive side, Schulte says that retail demand for milk, cheese, butter, and ice cream is up. Industry estimates from the International Dairy Foods Association say sales are as much as 60% higher than this same period, a time period last year. And more than a quarter of the COVID-19 cases in Minnesota are in healthcare workers. State Infectious Disease Director Chris Ayersman says the 300 are being closely monitored.
And so we've got a pretty strong effort to make sure that healthcare workers who may have been exposed are put into quarantine and follow-up.
Overall, about 4% of people tested in Minnesota for the virus are positive. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for the COVID-19 Town Hall Series on Main Street is provided by the Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota Caring Foundation.
And you're listening to Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're talking with Kirsten Basler and Jeff Holm, two experts on education, especially online delivery these days in North Dakota. Jeff, I asked Kirsten what wasn't working so well in the public, the K-12 education system in North Dakota, and she mentioned a couple of things that needed to be ironed out. How about at the university? This disruption in a short amount of time. Yes, you do have online learning, but are there some areas, some parts of the processes of the university that have been affected more than others and that you're kind of hoping to fix?
Well, I think the probably the most difficult thing that we've had to address is moving courses that have not been taught online before into the online environment. And then with those instructors, working with them to understand some of the issues that our students are facing. Kirsten mentioned the broadband connectivity, and we typically don't have too many issues related to that, but we do have students, unlike K through 12, we have students all over the country, if not the world, and so time zones, different time zones, and so trying to do synchronous activities, all gathering in the same session at the same time can be very challenging, difficult, and, I heard recently of some students in Hawaii who were having to get up at 4 a.m. or something like that to participate in their course. So we're working each day as things like that arise with instructors about some better ways to handle those kind of experiences, giving students the opportunity to interact with both the instructor and other students, but not necessarily all at the same time.
Yeah, we had a social gathering last Friday with a bunch of friends, and one of them was in Singapore, so our 5 o'clock meeting here was 6 in the morning there.
Yep.
Kirsten, we have a voicemail from a Fargo school parent with, I think, an important message. Another piece of the usual process of public education that's been lost here.
Hi, this is Sarah Abrams from Fargo, North Dakota. I know my daughter loves school and has been feeling the loss of that. She said that her feelings feel like she's on a roller coaster. She is feeling lost, so it's almost like grief, and she's lost school. She's lost contact with other adults, people she can talk to besides us. I'd say the most important part of this homeschooling journey has been making sure that we talk about our feelings.
Yes, Kirsten, we can't, forget the social experience that education is as well.
I couldn't agree with you more, and from the very first press conference on March 13th, and every time I have an opportunity, I try to bring out that aspect. It's our kids are nervous. Our children, our young people are nervous. And when I say young people, I mean all people, really. Our college-age students, their uncertainty. Our high school seniors that did not imagine that this spring was their last year, you know, the bookend on their K-12 career was going to end this way. Our young people that haven't seen grandma and grandpa in for so long, they are so, so uncertain right now, and they are looking to us as adults. I've relied heavily on Mr. Rogers. I remember when the Twin Towers fell in 2001, Mr. Rogers was just for us adults who grew up with him and our next generation of young people, that he was just a calm voice of reason. And I think I've relied on his quotes for many, many times during press conferences. And I think this mother's comments and voicemail that she shared out was very important. Please, let's not forget to be kind. And to our young people, to our families who have young people out there, the best thing to do is ask them what they've heard. They may have heard some misinformation that you might be able to debunk that misinformation. Don't tell them what you want to tell them. They have just ask the question what they have heard and what they want to talk about. Kudos and bravo to Sarah, to having such an open relationship. She's got a definite pulse on how her child is feeling like a roller coaster going up and down. It's so important. I'm actually going to just share a quote with Mr. Rogers, and it just says, "All of us at some time or another need help. Whether we're giving or receiving, each of us has something valuable to bring to this world. That's one of the things that connects us as neighbors. In our own way, each one of us is a giver and a receiver." So I think it's important for us to remember those things. And in the end, that's why I said it was so important not only to get our students through this year whole academically, but emotionally as well. And that's a priority. That's the primary goal, I think, that should be for all of us.
Jeff, you mentioned that some courses were a little more difficult to convert to online. About a week ago, I was talking to somebody in New York City who actually teaches acting at the City College of New York. And I was thinking, well, you can probably work with a student doing that, or work with an acting student, but you can't put on a play virtually. I mean, you can do a play reading, but you can't actually do the play. So let's talk about the activities that have been halted by this emergency, those kind of enrichment activities that are so important to universities, like athletics, musical performances, theater, those kinds of things. How's that being addressed?
You know, it's hard to answer that with one statement, because I think we're trying to address all those things in the way – I'll go back to what I said earlier. In many cases, the best solution, the best situation is one that's existed for a while. You mentioned a play, for example. So how can you do that kind of thing in a different way? And the alternatives are sometimes nowhere near as acceptable as the way we used to do it. But right now, we don't have any choice. I do want to come support what Kirsten was just saying. We can't forget that I think learning at all levels really is not just the topic in the academic part of what you're doing. It's also what you learn by working with people.
Yes.
To go through that topic, other students, working with your instructor. And so once again, in an online situation, some of those things we can do just as well, or even perhaps better. I mean, look at people in social media and through Facebook and Instagram. I mean, in some ways, that technology just adds to some of the experience. But in other ways, like you're talking about, so the athletic side of it, talking about intramurals, talking about concerts, musical concerts, plays, these are things that are very difficult to do in a virtual situation with physical distancing that people are doing. And I'd hope that what we're not able to do well is kept to the shortest possible time and interruption.
Kirsten, one of the headaches that school administrators have to deal with sometimes is that a teacher gets ill or has some incident happen that
gets in the way of him or her being in the classroom or online interacting with their students. So is substitute teaching more problematic when you're trying to adopt a teacher's online platform, or is it smoother? How does it work?
So I generally, from the indications that I've seen thus far, substitute teachers and the need for those haven't actually come up. I believe it probably, and I'm making an assumption here because I have no actual anecdotal story that I'm basing this on, but I do know that I had a call this afternoon, or early this morning actually, with my student cabinet members, and one of my student cabinet members from Napoleon had shared that they were doing their second pickup of information and second download of information. And so what she explained to me was that there was the initial distribution of whether they'd be physical materials for science courses or whatever materials might be needed to deliver it out. And it's been 2 weeks now since they've had instruction, and so they were doing their second pickup. What that leads me to believe is that there's a more advanced preparation. So the planning is much further in advance, and the recording of information and the downloading of information for students to continue their work at their own time and pace happens at a longer distance. And so when you wake up in the morning and you're feeling sick, not the same thing of having to physically drive to school and get yourself there. You still have your lessons prepared and planned. They've just been uploaded several days ago, and you're just checking in. So I'm thinking that's probably alleviating some of the substitution issues. I also want to share spinning off of your last comment and that was about the plays. I received an email last night that was just absolutely wonderful. It came from Amanda Peterson, who was Amanda is one of my teammates, but she was sent a video from Mr. Brian Saylor, the choir director from Bismarck High School and the former president of the National Association of Fine Arts Music Educators. And he shared this video with Amanda saying, "This is what virtual learning sounds like." And so it was a video and a PowerPoint slide. He recorded all of the individual voices of his choir, put them all together, and created this one recording. So they all did their own individual parts, sent it to their choir director. He synchronized it and created the most beautiful, beautiful rendition of Take Me Home. So this technology is stretching us.
Well, I have seen examples of that applied to symphony performances, for example, using Zoom with basically 100 people with different instruments in different places. But I can tell you, with a background in production, that would have been a headache to put together and would have taken hours and hours, I think. Let's talk about another issue here. Students with special needs, how are those being addressed in this time of pandemic isolation?
That most certainly is one of the biggest challenges and was one of our biggest concerns. It was one of our school district's biggest concerns as they and their greatest attention to detail as they were developing these distance learning plans. So we have several students, many, many students across the state that are on what we call individual education plans, IEPs, and what that designates is that they just need some special learning environments, different designations, some accommodations that are necessary in order for them to learn at their fullest potential. Those IEPs require team meetings, and they have a lot of check-ins and a lot of expectations. So the guidance that we received from the U.S. Department of Education was that school districts were to use their best faith effort, to use good faith effort in ensuring that the students would be receiving the same level of education and supports in a distance learning operation as they would have received in a building, the school building. And so lots of different examples out there. We've had several people stepping up like North Dakota does. There have been some assistive technology directors that have said we have some laptops and some computer devices that are already equipped with this assistive learning accommodation. So we've gotten those delivered out and connected people. We've had paraprofessionals be very accommodating and meet with these children and provide those supports and services. But without any hesitation, that still is certainly one of our biggest challenges, making sure that those students with the needs, the special unique needs that they have are being served adequately.
Jeff, I know that universities have extensive counseling services that are available for students who are dealing with some personal or academic issues, and advising services. I suspect the advising is pretty easily handed. online or in an email environment. But how about those counseling needs?
When you get into some of the counseling needs, you sometimes deal with licensure issues across state boundaries. And so there are resources available for emergency or critical needs. And then oftentimes a referral service is used if somebody needs more kind of long-term assistance in an online space.
I want to get to a large issue here that seems to have kind of grown in my mind, and I suspect in some others as well, as we've been adapting educational resources to online services here. Kirsten, is online public school instruction likely now to follow the model of higher education? That is, you might take classes where they're available and programs that are accredited or highly rated. And by that, I mean maybe picking teachers and school opportunities that are not necessarily in your community.
Well, I think it's going to accelerate some of those students taking advantage of those opportunities. North Dakota has had a longstanding agency called the Center for Distance Education. It used to be called the Center for Correspondence, or the Correspondence School. And about, I'd say, a decade ago, they transitioned completely to a virtual school. They're a virtual high school. They're an approved school that is approved from my office. And they've been offering distance learning, synchronous and asynchronous learning, for quite some time. And so we've had a number of school choice opportunities where students were taking advanced placement courses. They were taking courses that weren't offered in their school district or their school building. They were taking those from other entities that had offered that. So we've had a somewhat of a smattering of distance learning occurring in North Dakota for quite some time, and done very, very well, actually. What I think that this has accelerated and has done is to make it much more aware of people, much more aware of those opportunities that are out there, and removed some of the fear of, can I really do this? Is this something that we can support? So I think we've ripped the Band-Aid off in distance learning, and I'm sure that we won't ever go back to where we were in February of 2020.
I had a child who graduated using the distance learning capabilities, and that was quite a long time ago, so I'm aware of it. I'm just wondering if this doesn't maybe sort of make public K-12 systems more similar to colleges and universities, where you're actually looking at a particular school or program as opposed to a district and a place.
Oh, I would say that's probably very likely, too. And I think one of the things that we have been advocating for in K-12 education for a long time, and that has accelerated, is the idea of personalized education, of personalized and competency-based education, where we're not delivering the same material to 25, 30 students at the same time, but we are really meeting those students where they're at in their skill set, whether it be math, English, science, computer science, the arts, and we're progressing them through their learning journey. I think that's going to be one of the most significant differences as well, and I think if the entire country can transition to that type of understanding of what skill set does that child have or that young adult have, and what missing pieces or foundational concepts are they missing, and rather than having everyone go lockstep and measuring the amount of time that they spend in a classroom, but actually measuring the learning that's the constant,
yes,
instead of the time. So I hope that's where we go.
Jeff, this debate's been going on for a while, too, and it's especially keen in North Dakota because it has so many higher education institutions spread across the state with an awful lot of brick and mortar here and there. Does the move to online affect strategic planning in the sense that buildings might become a little less prioritized?
Well, the short answer to that is, yeah, I think so. I want to second what Kristen said about the personalized learning. I think that one of the, and it relates to your question here as well, I think one of the areas that online education and the technology that's associated with online education and the teaching methods that are connected to online education, all of them facilitate the development of really a much more personalized learning experience, where one person can start at a different place in the course than someone else. One person can move faster in the course than another person. And I think that, in my opinion, all education, but I'll speak, you know, to my particular area for sure, higher education, we really need to look at meeting people's learning needs in as flexible a fashion as possible. And by flexibility, I really mean, how are we providing it? How are we delivering it? And recognizing that people enter that space in very different places. And we have to be willing to accommodate and facilitate their journey through that space, given the circumstance or given where they come into it in.
Kirsten, this gets to the issue also for public schools, because you go around the state and most communities have this school there that they're very proud of, that they have these bond issues for. It's looked at as an economic development tool for communities. We've got this example of a structure here that means that we invest in education. Might what's happening here in the future weaken school bond support for expensive physical classroom structures?
You know, I've certainly got a number of questions about that and some comments in my inbox and some voice messaging on my telephone about that same idea. I think it has certainly underscored the understanding that it really isn't the building that matters as much as it is the teachers and the quality of instruction, the opportunities that we set up for students to learn. That is the primary, and buildings are secondary. But with that, I will also say that resources matter, that you hit it head on when you said communities are very proud of their schools, very proud, even when it's a very likely financial good decision to consolidate schools. Communities really want to maintain that. In North Dakota, we have a very, very strong local control system, and we really allow our local communities and the voters within those communities to determine whether they want to continue to support a school district beyond what the state is willing to support, and whether they want to build buildings or add on or make accommodations or, you know, make additions or remodeling. What we've seen is that voters use their voice when it comes time to that. There have been several school districts that the leaders thought that it would be better and more efficient to consolidate, and the people within those communities said, well, we know it's more efficient, but we're willing to pay the extra cost. We want both of them to stay open. So, I don't know. My crystal ball isn't even cloudy on that one. I think it's pretty black on that one. So time will tell whether the people of North Dakota want to continue to support those local schools. There's a lot of tradition that goes along with it, and you've seen that in the conversations about our Class B basketball tournament being canceled, and, you know, what are people going to do about prom and graduation. Even adults in our school communities are very, very tied and attached to those things.
Well, we'll leave it at that. There's a lot to think about here, and post-pandemic, we'll probably be wondering about what the new normal will look like. Kirsten Baszler is the North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction. Thank you for being with us today, Kirsten.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeff Holm is the Vice Provost for Online Education and Strategic Planning at the University of North Dakota. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and the people of North Dakota about online education.
And we thank the people who communicated with us to share their questions about what was going on with education as we were all hunkering down from COVID-19. We thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and Dakota Datebook is next.
While the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum events are canceled until May 4th for public safety and health, children and adults are invited to stay home and learn about North Dakota's rich history with free resources at ndstudies.gov. This message was brought to you by Prairie Public and the State Historical Society of North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them. This is Dakota Datebook for April 8th. On this date in 1905, the Washburn Leader alerted readers to the presence in North Dakota of what it called the peculiar loon. While associated more with forested states to the east, like Minnesota, Michigan, even New Hampshire, the loon can also be found in North Dakota. the bird's haunting and distinctive call can be heard for long distances. They are migratory, living on inland lakes from early spring to late fall or early winter. Shortly before ice begins to form, they migrate to the ocean, where they spend the winter. North Dakota is known for bison and wild horses, but the state also boasts an impressive variety of birds. The state bird is western meadowlark. There are bald eagles and golden eagles. Whooping cranes, which are another migratory species, can be found primarily in the western part of the state. Many other water birds make their homes in North Dakota, including a wide variety of gulls and ducks. The Audubon Society says that North Dakota may be the most underrated birding destination in the country. Even those who live in the state may be unaware of what makes North Dakota so special for birders. North Dakota has parks and refuges that provide habitat for both grassland and wetland birds. A lack of crowds and the ease of automobile travel add to the birdwatcher's experience. Thanks to several wildlife refuges in the Cheyenne National Grassland, birders can spot many hard-to-find species, like greater prairie chicken, sharp-tailed grouse, several types of sparrow. The ecosystem on the Missouri River below Garrison Dam boasts over 170 species, including 14 types of gulls. The area around Devil's Lake is also a fine destination for birdwatching. The lake itself offers a vital nesting area for many species of waterfowl. White Horse Hill, formerly known as Sully's Hill, is known as a habitat for bison and elk, but the birds should not be overlooked. Many species can be found in the preserve, including night herons, the American white pelican, and the double-crested cormorant. Anyone driving in North Dakota would be well advised to keep a birding book and a pair of binoculars handy. Even a short local drive can reveal a treasure trove of birds. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Life in New York City during this pandemic is anything but normal.
What's different about life now than before?
You have to be careful of people.
And as the city struggles with the coronavirus, New Yorkers try to find a way to stay safe and still meet their needs.
Be friendly to everybody. Keep a distance, of course. We'll get through this one way or another.
That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg will talk with Jack Russell Weinstein in a preview of this Sunday's Why radio show. Jack will be visiting with Dr. Susan Nyman from Potsdam, Germany. They'll address the question, what is the role of philosophy during times of global crisis? Tom Eason will share a Plainsfolk essay. Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats. And Matt Olean will review a new movie, the Jack London remake of The Call of the Wild. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.